Yeah. Facebook je weet aan te Sunny Rise to the Prabhupada.
Jai
Om Vishnu Pavamsa Prabhupada Gataya Sissi Mad Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasati Thakur Srila Prabhupada Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol. Can I have the Bhagavatam 10th canto volume 1, please? 옴 나모 바가바체 바수데바야
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 옴 나모 바가바체
Today we'll be hearing from Srimad Bhagavatam 10th Canto, Chapter 1, The Advent of Lord Krishna. Now, we'll be focusing on the area of Mathura. You can still find, of course, Mathura, 2 hours or so. Used to be 2 hours, 30 years ago. Now it's about a 3.5 hour drive from Delhi. All the places of Krishna's pastimes still exist. There's Mathura, there's Vrindavan. Just like people know that the places where the Bible activities took place, for the most part, they found a lot of these places. In Greek civilization, the places exist. Many places were thought to be mythological, just like the city of Troy was thought to be pure mythology, until one anthropologist who had a childhood ambition to find out, is that city of Troy a myth or not? He undertook archaeological research and indeed found that there is such a city as Troy. Similarly, in Israel and Egypt, cities that were thought to be mythological have been uncovered in the past 20 years. It's not that there's no trace of Krishna's pastimes in India. No, the places are there. Just like for Lord Ram, you have Ayodhya. For Lord Chaitanya, you have Navadvip. So for Krishna, you have Mathura, Vrindavan. The original Dwarka, that is a different thing, because the original Dwarka was a city in the ocean. Why is it that we think, Krishna is completely ahistorical, there's just nothing there? Kurukshetra is there, you can still go and find Kurukshetra. All the places of pilgrimage are still there. Hardwar, Bhadrak Ashram. So many places that are mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam are still there in India. It's just that the historical accounts of what happened at these places, that is lost. But the places aren't lost. Actually, of course, if you understand that Srimad Bhagavatam is the real history of ancient India, then you'll realize the historical accounts are not lost. The problem, however, is that Srimad Bhagavatam describes a level of human beings far beyond that level that exists today. So naturally, no one wants to accept that they're not so smart. People don't want to accept that there was a civilization and a people far advanced than what you have today. Therefore, mythology. It's got to be mythology if you're talking about anyone smarter than me. And certainly, how can anyone in India be smarter than the rest of the world? So for so many decades, and in fact centuries, scholars have been trying to locate the Aryans, the advanced people described in Vedic texts. They've been trying to locate them outside of India. First of all, they tried Europe. And Hitler was very expert at making that claim, that the Aryans are actually the Germans. Hitler was simply appropriating something devised by the scholars to show that the advanced people described in Vedic texts couldn't have been from India, they're actually from Europe, and then they went to India and civilized India, they brought Sanskrit, they brought the Vedic ways. When it was no longer possible to say that the Aryans or the Vedic advanced people came from Europe, then the scholars compromised. We don't want to say it's India. So, and we can't say it's Europe. We'll find a place in between, Central Asia. So anyway, it's not that everything about Lord Krishna has nothing to do with history, has nothing to do with archaeology. The places are there. You can go to Mathura now. You can go to Vrindavan now. Simply, it's a question of which authority do you want to believe. Do you want to accept the authority of Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam? Or do you want to accept the authority of mundane fools and rascals? Now, the events that we're going to be discussing happened approximately 5,000 years ago. Why there is no mundane historical account of all these events? Well, this earth undergoes many great changes. And simply, a periodic natural disturbance can cause massive shifts in geological situations. Just like someone was speaking yesterday, how the Saraswati River, its ancient riverbed, has been uncovered by satellite. Previous to that, it was thought that the mention of the Saraswati River as a great river running through India was pure myth. But Srimad Bhagavatam clearly mentions Balaram, Lord Balaram's pilgrimage along the Saraswati River, Maitreya and Vidura having discussions on the bank of the river Saraswati. That's the third canto of Bhagavatam. Saraswati plays a big role in Srimad Bhagavatam. But for so long, this was considered mythological, because after all, of course, the Bhagavatam is mythological, because it's describing a superior people than exists today, so it has to be mythological. Now, even Max Müller, at the end of the 19th century, he recognized, if indeed the Saraswati River ever appears again, as described in the Vedic literatures, it will be a mighty blow. Because if indeed the Saraswati River existed, as the Vedas describe, then you'll have a hard time saying the Vedas are mythological. So Max Müller, although his whole mission was to destroy Vedic knowledge and to destroy the people's faith in Vedic knowledge, he recognized, if indeed the Saraswati River ever appears as it's described in Bhagavatam, in the Vedas, then we're in big trouble. And that's exactly what happened recently by satellite technology. That dried up riverbed of the Saraswati River has been detected. Now, so many scholars are trying their best how to consider it not so important. Because the implications are too devastating. How is it that Srimad Bhagavatam talks about the Saraswati River as a reality, and now the existence of that river is known to be a fact? Could it be that the Bhagavatam is factual? Oh, this is too revolutionary in its implication. Alright, so we're in the area of Mathura, and we're dealing with a powerful Kshatriya family. A Kshatriya family not by birth, but with real noble qualifications, as described by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Soryam Teja Dhatir Daksham Yude Kshatriya Palayanam. The Kshatriya is heroic. He has powerful abilities. He's expert. He never turns his back in battle. Ishwar Bhava. He has the controlling nature for the benefit of the people. So Vasudeva, he is a Kshatriya, and also he's marrying a wife, Devaki, who is in the Kshatriya line, Kshatriya family. Together, both of them are going to be the future parents of Lord Krishna. Now, bear in mind what Krishna himself explains in Bhagavad Gita. Ajopi san avyatma bhutanam ishvaropi san. Krishna says, I'm unborn, yet I still appear in this material world. This is the greatest mystery, how the unborn apparently takes birth. Krishna doesn't need a mother or father. He's both the mother and father of the entire cosmic manifestation. Yet, because some devotees want to love him in a parental way, Krishna appears to take a mother and father for the sake of his pastimes, his pleasurable, voluntary activities. You cannot say that you appeared to take a mother and father. Birth in this world was forced upon you by the laws of nature. But Krishna's birth is not forced. Therefore, it's actually not a birth. Therefore, Krishna is known as Aja, unborn. Actually, you are also Aja, unborn, as the spirit soul. But because you have come under the false concept of thinking you're the body, you're forced to take birth. Even though you're spirit soul, you're forced to come under the influence of the laws of nature. Krishna, however, when he appears in this world, never takes a material body. He appears as he is in his original spiritual form. We are forced to take birth, even though we're spirit soul, we're forced to take a material body, which covers the soul. Krishna never takes a material body. That is the difference. Alright. Now, we're going to a wedding day. Many of you will experience a wedding day in your life. Of course, even if you're not married now, you have been to many weddings. And you know that even today in India, weddings are a gala event. They're a big thing. Not so big in the West anymore. As you know, in Australia, many couples choose not to marry. What's the big deal? One sociological study was done in England amongst teenage girls who had given birth outside of marriage. As I told you, England is the teen pregnancy capital of Europe. So these girls were interviewed, and they were living with their partners, so many of them. And they all said the same thing. There's no need for marriage. Why? We're just committed to each other. That's all that counts. We'll be together. We've had a child. What's the need of marriage? They all had this conviction, we're going to be together. But the statistics show they're not going to be together for long. But they're all saying like that. What's the need of marriage? We're going to be together. We have a mutual bond. We care for each other. Why marriage? Why this formality? Child is already there. We have a nice scene between us. What's the problem? This is illusion. They don't understand that statistics show their relationship would be very short-lived. But they all felt like it. It's going to be all right. Everything's going to be fine. Here in Australia, as you know, even those who marry have to protect themselves. They make a prenuptial agreement that in the likely event of divorce, whatever assets each partner brings to the marriage remains in the original hands of that marriage partner. So just so you have to be prepared to defend yourself. Defend your assets. And the way the laws now work in New Zealand and Australia is even if you don't marry, but you are living together, that's considered a de facto marriage, and still your wife can have a go at all your assets, even though you haven't married her. Just the fact that you've lived together for so long establishes that, in the eyes of the law, that this is a steady relationship. And if it breaks up, then each one of you can have a go at the assets. Whoever hires the best lawyer wins. So, this is the way it is. And if you raise children in Australia, this is the atmosphere they'll be growing up in. And this is what they'll be telling you. Marriage? Why do we have to marry? We just feel for each other. Isn't that enough? We're just naturally meant to be together. And also, it's much more advanced. It's much more advanced to first live together and see if you can make it with each other. That's the higher way of doing things. This is what they're going to be telling you. Your kids will be telling you this. And what are you going to say? Oh. And then imagine what their kids are going to tell you. Your grandchildren. It'll be even worse. I doubt that your children will be asking you to live together with their boyfriend or girlfriend in your house. That's common now in Australia and New Zealand. But I don't think your children will do that. But your grandchildren will probably do it. Because things just get worse and worse and worse. All right. So, amongst the Indian community, weddings are still a big deal. You know, the father has been protecting the daughter. And the daughter has not been with any man. And the handing over of the father... the father's handing over of the daughter to the husband, it's a big thing because, as you all know, the daughter then becomes part of the husband's family. So it's a very emotional moment for the father that he's sending his daughter off. I was speaking a few days ago at the Melbourne Temple about tragedies that happen on wedding days. These are the most... upsetting events. How? On such a glorious day. It used to be that girls would look forward to their marriage day with, you know, this is like being coronated as queen. And a man would look forward to it also because now their relationship would be legitimized and they could properly have intimate relationships without scorn of society. So it was a big thing. It's a very good thing. My mother, she told me when I was a young boy, she said, you know, I was chaste up until the night of my marriage, you know, the first night of marriage, but for you, I recommend, don't marry so quickly. Spend time shopping around. Try this one, try that one, make sure it's the right one for you. Of course, when she told me that, she didn't mean to have, you know, illicit physical relationships. No, she's totally against that. But at the same time, she thought, it's not good that you marry at a young age. You know, I married my high school sweetheart. I was 20 when I married the person who I had been dating since I was 17. I remember my father, he, after graduating from high school, he went sailing around the world as part of a crew on a ship. And he visited many countries, many continents, India, Africa, South America. Both he and my mother are from strict Christian families. But when he came back from his world tour, he got off the boat. My mother was meeting him at the harbor. And he just happened to mention to her something he regretted saying. He said, in my travels around the world, I have seen that there are many different ways of worshiping God. I've seen, actually, that people are sincere worshiping God in other ways. And I've realized that Jesus isn't the only way. Immediately, my mother knew what to do at the age of 18. She lifted up her hand, pulled off the engagement ring, handed it back to him. My father quickly shuffled. He quickly, did an instant replay and what I meant actually was. What I really meant was that he just juggled around and somehow covered the whole situation over. And then he gave my mother the ring back and she put it back on. So I always say, well, Father, what would have happened if you hadn't, covered this thing over and hadn't juggled your words? Well, I don't know. You would have never been born then. That was all he could answer. So anyway, weddings are meant to be a celebration of stability for society, a recognition that there's going to be proper commitment and obligation. And of course, weddings in Krishna consciousness mean that each partner is pledging to assist each other in spiritual development, not simply in material affairs or physical and mental affairs, but there's actually going to be spiritual enhancement to the relationship. Now, we're speaking about tragedies on wedding days. A few days ago, we were talking about how, I remember when I was a little boy reading in the newspaper that there was going to be a marriage, and the marriage was on Sunday morning, and then it was Saturday night, and the future bride, future husband, they were at the girl's mother's house making all the last minute arrangements. It was an atmosphere of excitement. You can understand, some of you have been to a marriage, had your own wedding the night before, is very exciting. So then the future husband, who was to be married the next day, the next morning, he drove home on the Saturday night. And because he was tired, he fell asleep at the wheel. Car crashed, and that was the end of him. Just as a little boy, I was wondering, how does this feel? What is this girl feeling? Just see, she's right there at the glorious moment of her life, and then it's all finished. So the newspapers were interviewing the family, and the mother was saying, I guess we'll just have to give all the wedding gifts back, and this is a complete tragedy. But this is the way material nature is. These are the things we don't like to think about. This is the real world. What was meant to be the most glorious day turned into a great tragedy. Instead of a wedding, you have a funeral. Then recently, example I told you before, past 3 years, here in Australia, a New Zealand couple, they had lived together for some years, but they decided to get married. And after their marriage, they came to Australia for their honeymoon. And they were at a hotel on the Australian coast, and the man got up early in the morning to go for an early morning surf. And he left his wife sleeping in bed. You could just visualize her sleeping peacefully in bed, knowing her husband was just going for a you know, a quick surf in the water, he'd be back soon. The spot in that bed was still warm where he lay. And what happened while the husband was out surfing? A shark came and swallowed him. Swallowed him and the surfboard, spit out the surfboard, and kept him inside and swam away. A few people could see it from afar, and they called the police, and the police began to figure out who was this person. So you can imagine, there you are, the wife laying in bed, having a nice honeymoon, belly packed with, so much food and wine, and you're an Australian couple, you're probably smoking marijuana too. And the spot on the bed where your husband lay is still warm. You're just waiting for him to come back. You're having a late morning sleep. And then there's a knock on the door. You jump up. You open the door and it's the police. And instantly you know something's wrong. And they tell you your husband has been killed by a shark and there's not even any trace of the body. This is life in the real world. And recently, just when I was in Delhi last week, there was a wedding, and someone, they fired off the shots, the gunshots after the wedding. What kind of people do that? Who shoot, fire the guns after the wedding?
Some people in North India. Some people from Rajasthan.
Gujarati and North India.
So they drinking or are they just
firing fireworks?
But were they also drinking or just drinking and they fire off the guns? So one person at the wedding died of gunshot. Very sad. And the family tried to cover it up by cremating the body immediately like that. But the police did find out. And then the police pointed out that just last year in Delhi, when they were firing off the gunshots, the husband died. The husband, on his wedding day, he died. They were celebrating. And the man who had just married died. That's very tragic. So if you were in that situation, what would you say? You wouldn't be laughing. Think of a girl in that situation. Men can be a little bit hard-hearted sometimes with the ladies. This is very bad. It's horrible. How would you feel in that kind of situation? The man dies on his wedding day. Everyone's celebrating. And the bullet hits him. That's it. Horrible. Now let's go to another tragedy on the wedding day. This is Vasu Dev and Devaki. We'll read from the 10th canto of Bhagavatam. Tasyam tukarajit chaurir vasudeva krito draha devatya suryaya sardham prayane vratham aruhat. Some time ago, Vasudeva, who belonged to the demigod family, or to the Shura dynasty, married Devaki. After the marriage, he mounted his chariot to return home with his newly married wife. Now, Kamsa was Devaki's sister. It was the custom that in order that the newly married girl would feel comfortable leaving the home of her father and going to stay with her husband for the first time, to make her feel comfortable, the brother would accompany her to the house. You see, in Vedic culture, everything is done very tastefully, taking into account everyone's feelings. The whole point of Vedic culture is to diminish anxiety so that people can properly concentrate on spiritual life. But if you forget the goal of concentrating on spiritual life, then Vedic culture doesn't have much value at all. As we discussed yesterday, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Vedaishta Sarvai Ahameva Veja, by all the Vedas I am to be known. In other words, Vedic culture means Krishna culture. That is the goal. So, Kamsa is driving the chariot of his sister and his new brother-in-law. And it's a great procession because Vasudeva is very prestigious, Kshatriya, Vedic administrator. So his chariot is surrounded by hundreds of golden chariots, and Devaki's father is named Maharaj Devak. He's a very powerful king, and he's very affectionate to his daughter, as all fathers are. I remember my father telling me, you know, I was asking, why do you give so much attention to the daughter? What about the sons? In other words, what about me? You give her everything. He just looked at me and said, son, you have to understand, a daughter is a special thing in the father's life. So anyway, Devaka, because of his great affection for his daughter Devaki, gave her a huge dowry. You know how in India, if the dowry isn't sufficient, the bride's family will even kill because of this. Because it's very important that the dowry be sufficient, because the daughter doesn't inherit the property of the father. So to compensate for that, the daughter gets from the father a big dowry at the time of marriage, and there's been violence. I've read about it in the papers in India. If the dowry doesn't turn out to be sufficient, the wife's family is very insulted to the point of violence. They're relying on that income. In fact, I was reading in the newspaper, one family has specified, they had given a shopping list for the dowry. We want 2 air conditioners, 2 color TVs, this, that, the other. And the husband's family didn't deliver. So they got so angry that there was violence. Anyway, the purpose of the dowry, as I said, is that the woman does not inherit the father's property. Now, contemporary feminists consider this to be outrageous. They consider it to be oppressive. But we have to understand that in Vedic culture, although the daughter doesn't inherit the father's property, she is thinking, my real wealth is the children. It's totally opposite from contemporary female thinking. Our real wealth is his wealth, and we're going to get it. One famous movie star, who had divorced several times, gave her advice to all women folk in the world, what to do when your marriage breaks apart. She said, be practical. When you leave him, don't get angry. Get everything. Why waste time getting angry? Get every penny that he has. Take all his wealth. And of course, contemporary women, they'll kill their own child in the womb. They'll neglect their own child. Why? Because my own convenience comes first. But in Vedic culture, the woman's wealth is the children. In a nice, proper marriage, the husband is in charge of the external affairs. And inside the house, that's the wife's territory. What to do with the children, cooking, like that. Very, very quickly, the husband learns to keep his nose out of that. He values his life. So, children are wealth. It's not seen that way now in current society. And therefore, people protest. What kind of system is this that the wife, that the daughter cannot inherit the property of the father? This is barbaric. They don't understand how in Vedic culture everything balances. Everyone gets something. Everyone gets what they need. So, Devaki's father gave her a great dowry. 400 elephants, nicely decorated with golden garlands, 10,000 horses, 1,800 chariots, and 200 very beautiful young maid servants, fully decorated with ornaments. So Prabhupada writes here, these are all old customs in the society of Varnashram Dharma, which is now wrongly designated as Hindu. These long-standing customs are nicely described here. This word Hindu is found nowhere in the Vedic literature. It's just a modern concocted word. Basically, Hindu means anything that goes on the Indian subcontinent. That's Hindu. From worshipping Vishnu to worshipping snakes to anything. If it goes on below the Himalayas, it's Hindu. If it happens outside, if it happens below Pakistan and below the Himalayas, it's Hindu. Hindu actually is just a general term that can refer to anything. The correct term we've been using is Sanatan Dharma, the eternal occupational duty of the living entity. All right, so the procession has started. The wedding's over, and the wedding procession is going to the new home of the bride and groom. So there's a big musical celebration, conch shells, bugles, drums, kettle drums, all vibrating in concert to create an auspicious departure. Kamsa is driving the chariot of his wife, excuse me, his sister and his new brother-in-law, Vasudev. Now, who is Kamsa? Although he's born in a very high-class dynasty, he is a complete tumor. He is totally obnoxious. He's like a Stalin. Or who's the one who's in charge of Cambodia? Yes. He's like that. Although he's born in such a prestigious, elevated family, he's an aberration. He's like a freak occurrence. Even in the best family, sometimes a very bad son occurs. So Kamsa was like that. He was a despot. He was a tyrant. So he's driving the chariot, controlling the reins, and suddenly an unembodied voice booms from the sky. Kamsa, you are such a fool. The eighth child of the woman you are carrying in your chariot will kill you. Now, what was Kamsa's reaction? What would your reaction be? What would you do if you were Kamsa? Huh?
Kill the child.
What's that?
Kill the child.
You would do that. Okay, better put, if you were in Kamsa's place, what would you do?
Yeah, that's it.
What's that?
Same thing.
You would do that.
Not me, Kamsa.
You understand. You're you, but you're in his situation. What would you do? What would you do? Nothing? What would you do?
He is going to repent for his past karma. Whatever he has done, he will have to pay for that.
Anyone else?
Stay
away. You just say, let it be.
Stay away from the lady.
How many would say, just let it be? Raise your hands. How many would take some proactive stance? What would you do proactively?
Stay away from the family.
Anyone else?
Make them
separate. Make them
separate. Read Krishna's pastime.
Read Krishna's pastime.
God's pastime.
Why?
Do some God activity. Once you know that you're going to die.
Very good. Do you do that now?
No,
because you are going to die. Anyone else? What about ladies? You can speak here. What would you think that?
I just think it's some weird stuff going on. Wouldn't believe it.
You wouldn't believe it.
I'll just pray to Lord Krishna.
Get me out of this jam, huh? But Kamsa, he has no good qualities. He's a demoniac. He knew just what to do. He's very envious. He's very sinful. He's a condemned personality. As soon as he heard this voice speak from the sky, he grabbed his sister's hair with his left hand, took up his sword with his right hand, and prepared to cut her head off of her body. He was horrible. This is just abominable. How could he do such a thing? But look at it from the modern point of view. He's just doing what's necessary to protect his own sense gratification. Isn't that the goal of today's so-called civilization? do what you gotta do to get ahead, you know? Do what you gotta do in order to survive. The voice has spoken. So, if this woman gives birth to child number 8, that's the end of Kamsa. Why should he just let that happen? He should get rid of her first and solve the whole problem. Now just see, before this voice spoke, Kamsa had been so affectionately driving the chariot. Oh, my sister, on her wedding day. You can imagine the sentiments, you know, it's a big family affair, you know. Very moist with emotions and family ties like that. Yes, you've all been to occasions like that, yes? Yeah. But in a moment, he changes as soon as he hears that his own sense gratification is threatened. In a moment, he prepares to kill her. Now you would say, oh, this is very extreme. I would never do such a thing like that. But who decides what is extreme? If you're just making your own laws, if you're just making your own dharma, then how far is too far out? Is it always decided by you? Or is there some overarching laws that we should be paying attention to? My point is that as soon as you're always being the judge of what is right and wrong, you'll find that you'll change your tune. I don't know if any of you have had that experience, and I won't ask you, but you might remember you're going back on your own moral codes because of a situation. Something you said you'd never do, you did because, well, you know, it was just a situation, you know, something happened, and, well, you know, that's just the way it is. Well, in that same spirit, Kamsa is acting. You would not approve of Kamsa's choice of activity, but still, let's understand the same philosophy is there. You got to do what you got to do to advance your own interests. Circumstances happen. Things happen. You might have said you'd never do such a thing. Just like while working, you'll be forced into compromising situations. I told you about one devotee who was working for Anderson Consulting when it used to be top. Yes, it's gone down since some scandal. Yes. So he was working for Anderson, and he was, he's from India, 25 years old, and university graduate, so he got a position with Anderson Consulting, you know, the top of the pile. And he had to work under a department head who was an Australian girl who wasn't university educated, but she had been with the company since she was 18. So she was the department head, and she was, you know, about 26 or 27. And he was a new employee, a new hotshot, you know, fresh out of business school. And so the company told him that you have to, you know, go through the ranks. We'll move you up quickly, but you have to start in her department, and then we'll see. So he said, sure, all right. So he was doing his job dutifully. But this Australian girl had a thing about Indian men. I've heard in your country how women are treated. I've heard about how in your country women are oppressed and exploited. Well, guess what? This is Australia, and I'm going to teach you a thing or two. So, she went out of her way to make his life miserable, just lording it over him, do this, do that, why isn't this done, why isn't that done? Even the other departments at Anderson noticed, department heads, they noticed, and they told him, yes, we know she's really working you over, but you have to tolerate this to prove your loyalty to the company. And so he was just, really feeling beat down. She was just rubbing it in day after day, week after week, treating him like a menial slave and showing him, you know, the power of a liberated woman. And so he didn't know how long he could take it. One Monday morning, he came to work and he saw that she had been crying. And she called him over to her desk and started talking to him like, you know, I really think we ought to talk some more. I really need someone to talk to right now. I really want to relate to you. Why don't we just go somewhere right now and have a cup of coffee? And he was like, oh, what's going on here? Like, oh my God. First she's lording over me and treating me like a slave. Now it seems she's propositioning me. She started telling him, I had a very bad weekend. You know, my boyfriend treated me so horribly. But you look like a nice person. And he was so it was a tight situation for him. He told me, he was thinking, well, this could be an easy way to get out of the suffering if I just, you know, pacify her. You know, so my working days will be much easier. Maybe I should just, you know, comply, and then, you know, she won't be giving me such a hard time. No, I can't do that. My family has arranged a marriage for me back in Delhi. What to do? What to do? And she's pushing. Come on, let's just go talk. I mean, really, I mean, I might have been a little hard on you in the past. But, you know, and not only talking with the mouth, but also talking with the body, you know. You know, I think that, you know, maybe we are, you know, compatible in a way that we haven't realized yet. And he was like, oh. Half his mind was saying, yes, yes. The other half was saying, Vishnu, Vishnu. Finally, he decided he wasn't going to do this. He just kind of, he made some excuse. I have an appointment down the hall with another department head or something like that. And so it was a very tight situation. We're all going to be put in situations like that. So what is our standard for how to proceed? You'll say, I would never do what Kamsa's about to do. But what is your standard? Is it just what you feel is right at the moment? That'll always change. You know, you've already been through circumstances in which you compromise your own previously designated morals. You know that. Oh, I would never lie. I would never cheat. I would never do this. I would never do that. And then a convenient opportunity came, or an opportunity came in which you felt there's no other choice. You just did the necessary. So what is the standard? Is it you? Do you create dharma? That is the actual point. So don't be so hard on Kamsa, treating him like he's totally grotesque. Try to see how in a smaller degree, to a much more minor degree, the same tendencies might be in us to be the source of our own dharma and to do what's convenient based on the circumstances. All right. So here's Kamsa with the Devaki's hair in his left hand, the sword in his right hand, ready to solve the situation. Now the husband, the brand new husband, Vasudev, has to do something. He knew he couldn't attack Kamsa. Kamsa is the biggest brute of his time. So he had to use intelligence. He began to address Kamsa in such a way as to try and pacify him. Vasudev knew, I'm going to be the father of Bhagavan Sri Krishna. I've got to protect the situation so that Krishna indeed can take birth as our son. So, Vasudev begins to speak to Kamsa. Now, notice Vasudev's sense control, his great discipline in this extraordinary crisis. My dear brother-in-law Kamsa, you are the pride of your family, the Bhoja dynasty, and great heroes praise your qualities. How could such a qualified person as you kill a woman, your own sister, especially on the occasion of her marriage? So first, Vasudev is appealing to Kamsa's reputation. He's puffing him up. You are the pride of your family. Great heroes praise your qualities. How could such a qualified person as you do this? In Vedic culture, you cannot kill a woman, an old man, a child, or a calf. So Vasudeva is pointing out, not only is Devaki a woman, she's your sister, and this is her wedding day. How could a great person like you ever think of doing such a thing in such circumstances? Mm. And then Vasudeva says, Mrityur janma vatam viveva dehena sahajayate ajyavabdha shatante va mrityur vai praninam dhruva. O great hero, one who takes birth is sure to die, for death is born with the body. One may die today or after hundreds of years, but death is sure for every living entity. I think one of you here said like that. Why should Kamsa do this horrible thing just to avoid death when everyone's going to die? So that's the argument Vasudeva gave him. You're a great hero, but you should understand. You're going to die. You'll die today or after 100 years, but everyone's going to die. So why commit sinful activities just to stop death, which is going to happen to everyone anyway? Why ruin your reputation? Why stain the reputation of your family just to stop death? Now, in Krishna consciousness, the point is not to fear death, but to prepare oneself. Don't die in ignorance. Use your living days to prepare for death and your next birth. Use your time in this valuable human form of life to end the process of birth and death. That is your number one priority. Not that you just live your life aimlessly and then death comes. Use your time to stop the process of birth and death. This is why Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, is the most practical knowledge. It's the greatest experience of the real world, stopping the cycle of repeated birth and death. So why should one commit sinful activities just to save oneself from death, which will come anyway? That's Vasudeva's argument. And the next thing he says is that when the present body you have turns to dust and goes back to the earth, you'll get another body in your next life according to your activities in this life. When the next body is obtained, you give up the present body. So why go through so much trouble to preserve the body, even to the extent of committing horribly sinful activities, when at the end of the body's duration, it turns to dust, goes back to the earth. It's burned, it's buried, and the worms eat it. Or if you die in an abandoned, lonely place, your body may just drop on the ground and some wild animal will eat it. So this is the destination of the body. Why should you commit sinful activities when this is going to happen to the body anyway? And when the present body dies, nature gives you another body. This cycle is going on. So therefore, Vasudeva is explaining, since this cycle is going on, why should you commit such a horribly sinful activity? The cycle is going to go on. Better you learn how to get out of the cycle than do a horrible activity that will make the cycle even worse for you. Then Vasudeva starts to give very graphic examples, teaching Kamsa as well as teaching us about the science of the transmigration of the soul, which is popularly known as reincarnation. He says, just as a person traveling on the road rests one foot on the ground and then lifts the other, or as a worm on a vegetable transfers itself to one leaf and then gives up the previous leaf, so the conditioned soul takes shelter of another body and then gives up the one he had before. At the time of death, generally speaking, your next body is established. And therefore you step from your present body, which is going back to the earth as elements, you step from your present body into your future body. Just like a worm transfers itself from one leaf to another. First it puts part of its body on the new leaf, and then lifts off from the old leaf. Similarly, when according to your karma, your next birth is decided, you step into that birth, so to speak, and lift your foot out of your old body. You lift off out of the old body. You see, death means that the karma of your present body has run out. It's time to go to your new body, which is a storehouse of the new karma awaiting you. It's not that your karma has been finished. No, it's simply that the karmic reactions that you're supposed to get in this body are finished. But while you have this body, you are piling up karmic reactions for the future. And those you must experience in the new body. So as Prabhupada writes in the purport, this is the process of the soul's transmigration from one body to another. At the time of death, according to his mental condition, the living being is carried by the subtle body, consisting of mind, intelligence, and ego, to another gross body. When higher authorities have decided what kind of gross body the living entity will have, he is forced to enter such a body, and thus automatically he gives up his previous body. This understanding is very important for us to utilize the resources of our lifetime properly. This concocted crazy idea that one life is all you have prevents you from seeing what's really going on. Prevents you from using this life to prepare for the best possible birth in your next life. You can't understand nature. Everywhere you look, nature works in cycles. The seasons, summer, autumn, winter, spring. You look at ecological cycles replenishing themselves and rejuvenating and then expending themselves. You look at the forest here at this wonderful place. You can see the cycles of nature all around you. Why is it that we think that our stay in our particular body is not part of a cycle? So the soul goes from one body to another. This is the cycle of transmigration, repeated birth and death. Now, later today we're going to be dealing with the subject of fatalism, which is a great criticism leveled against Indian culture, Vedic culture. We'll be dealing with that this afternoon. Because often it's said in the West that because the Indian people accept that there's a next life and that there's karma, therefore they don't have that aggressive materialistic attitude to achieve because they think everything is already predestined. And therefore they can't really get the country together for extraordinary economic advancement. Any of you heard this before?
Yes.
Because they have this fatalistic belief that everything is predestined, the way it is the way it's meant to be. They don't have that acquisitive, go-ahead spirit to get to the top. In other words, they can't take the situation into their own hands. They're enslaved by this understanding of karma. Oh, the way it is the way it is. Just let it happen. This is the conception many Westerners have. And even people in India now are thinking like that. This is what's holding us back. This Dharma understanding, this Shastra understanding is impeding our advancement, both as a nation and as an individual. Better you think it's all up to you and your efforts. Then you'll get ahead. What do you think? Yes? You think?
Yes.
Better think it's all up to you, right?
No. Oh. To a certain extent, it's up to you.
To what extent?
That's the question.
Yeah, that's the question. That's why you're here, right? Very good. Okay. We'll be talking about that this afternoon. But right now, we're going to conclude with discussing the power of the mind. In Vasudeva's explanation to Kamsa, of the transmigration of the soul, you're going to learn a lesson in how powerful the mind is. Because the mind is the engine of reincarnation. It's the engine of the souls moving from one body to another. Now, Vasudeva explains this power of the mind in a brilliant way. He gives you the example of daydreaming. You all know that when you're daydreaming about something, you can get into that daydream so intensely that you forget everything that's happening around you. Has that ever happened to you? You started dreaming, maybe you're thinking of family and friends back in India or places you used to go to in India, and you start thinking about it so intensely you forget all what's happening around you. Or maybe your fiance is in India and you haven't seen her for a while. Or maybe if your family is really traditional, you haven't even met her, you won't meet her till the day of the marriage. Does that happen? Does that still happen? Huh? No. You meet before, yes? Huh?
At least one time.
It's not that, you know, the old style, you know.
You never met before.
You never? You met her at the marriage?
Yeah.
Just one day before marriage.
Still before.
But it's for the marriage. I mean, for the marriage ceremony, it's not...
Oh, it was part of the marriage ceremony.
Yeah.
Okay. Which village was this?
It's in AP,
Andhra Pradesh.
Hyderabad.
Hyderabad.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not a village. But still, your family's very traditional, yes?
We give importance to culture and tradition.
Why?
Why? Because we respect that. And
why?
We believe in that.
Believe in what?
Believe in culture and God.
Why? Believe in what?
Believe in God and...
What is that? What is God?
It's basically like I listen to my parents and I know what my parents do for me and I give all rights to them, so they decided I also liked it, that's all.
Isn't the most traditional way that you don't see the bride's face until the marriage time? There's a moment when she pulls the sari back over the face, and for the first time you see. That's the most traditional way, yes? Does that happen to anyone here? You might be dreaming, daydreaming. Huh? You're discussing your future marriage. So you could be daydreaming. Oh, what will she be like? Maybe you've seen her once, and she's in India. You're working in Melbourne, and you're dreaming. Oh, I've seen her once. It'll be like this. It'll be like that. It happens like. Yeah. Your wife is not here, right?
No.
All right, you can say. It's natural, right? It's an important thing in life, and you're visualizing. You're visualizing in your mind what it's going to be like. You also did like that? Yeah, of course. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Of course, it's natural. You're going to spend your life with a person. Naturally, you're trying to project in your mind, visualize what it's going to be like. I think we'll do this. I think we'll do that. Right? And sometimes you can even forget about your present circumstances, right? Certainly you did while he was away, right? Of course. So the point is made by Vasudeva that you can get so much caught up into this daydreaming, you forget everything around you. You're like entering another world. So he uses that to show you how the mind takes you to another body. By the power of the mind, because of the way the mind is shaped during your present birth, it takes you to the next body according to the quality of the mind. So listen to what he says. Swapne yata pashati deham idrasam manovatena vinivishta chaitana. Dristat sutabhyam manasanu chintayan prapadyate tat kim api yapasmati. Having experienced a situation by seeing or hearing about it, one contemplates and speculates about that situation. And thus, one surrenders to it. In other words, you surrender to your contemplation of that situation. You really get into it. And you forget all about your present body. Similarly, by mental adjustments, this is another example. We've done the daydream. Now Vasudeva is speaking about the night dream. By mental adjustments, one dreams at night of living under different circumstances, in different bodies, and forgets his actual position. You all have the experience of dreaming at night. Your body is laying in bed, but you're off in another world. You forget all about your body laying in the bed, and you are running around in your dream body doing so many things. You forget your actual position until the alarm clock rings. And then you wake up, oop, I have to go to work. So Vasudeva explains, under this same process, one gives up his present body and accepts another. As Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, tata dehantara prapti. You give up the present body and accept another body, and the whole process is driven by your mind. According to the mental state at the time of death, you get another body that matches your mind. You get a gross body that matches the subtle body, the mind. This is explained by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Yam yam bhapi smaran bhavam chajante kalevram. Whatever is the state of mind at your time of death, that determines what your next body will be. So Vasudeva is here pointing out how powerful your mind is. It drives you even to your next body. What the mind becomes absorbed in becomes reality. It manifests as a gross body.
Excuse me.
I'll wait till I finish. I'll get to the end. So, we should think about this. The mind is the subtle substance in which the body is created. We actually experience this in our dreams and also when we are daydreaming. We must understand that the process of mental speculation develops a new type of body that does not actually exist. If you can understand the nature of the mind and its thinking, feeling, and willing, you can very easily understand how from the mind different types of bodies develop. Very important. Therefore, the Krishna conscious process is focused on purifying the mind, training the mind to be an instrument in Krishna's service, so that you'll get the best possible body in your next life. You'll get a spiritual body because the mind is spiritualized. So Vasudeva has pointed out how powerful the mind is, how the mind is the engine of transmigration of the soul. You should start to think about all the power that's contained in your mind and how to get it under control. An uncontrolled mind will take you to unpredictable types of bodies in your next life. Just like a forest fire that's out of control, it jumps from tree to tree unpredictably. Similarly, the uncontrolled mind will take you to unknown destinations in your next life. One of our devotees, she's an old Australian lady, she's my initiated disciple, doubly. She was telling me about an almost death experience she had. She was driving on a road and she hit a patch of ice. And the patch of ice was, right on a bridge as she crossed over a big, what do you call it, canyon? Or what's the, the bridge was crossing a valley?
Canyon.
And she hit the patch of ice and her car flipped over the side of the bridge and rolled down the side of the canyon heading towards the river at the bottom of the canyon. And only because there was an old tree standing up did her car not go into the river. Her car was tumbling down the side of the canyon and it hit against the only tree that was there for a great distance. And and the tree stopped her car from going all the way down into the river. So she was trapped in her car. She couldn't get out. And she had a few broken ribs and like that, and she couldn't move, and no one was around. So she told me. I said, well, what were you thinking at that moment when all that happened? When the car finally stopped tumbling and resting against the tree, and what was in your mind? She thought, well, I thought, I have to go get help, but I can't move. And my body can't move, my ribs are broken, there's no one around. Then she remembered, she said, I haven't finished my rounds. She just started chanting her japa. I haven't finished my 16 rounds today. So she just started chanting as the car is resting against the old tree and the river is right below. And you know, she's balanced very precariously. But I didn't finish my rounds. I'll just chant. So she chanted for a while, and then some or other, she got the strength to get out of the car and crawl up to the road and signal somebody. And then they, of course, called the ambulance. They brought her to the hospital. The doctors were astonished. How did you crawl in your condition from the car up to the road, you old lady? But she said, all the time I was just thinking, I've got to finish my rounds today. I've got to finish my rounds. I've got to finish chanting Hare Krishna. So, this is showing you how the mind works in critical moments. It has extraordinary powers which are brought out in Krishna consciousness. These extraordinary powers are brought out in Krishna consciousness for the purpose of thinking how to serve Krishna. All right. Are there any questions? Yes.
Maharaj, you just said that you can kill any person if he is going to be the cause of your death. So in that understanding, how Kamsa killing the children is, or trying to kill Devaki is not is a sin?
Because, yes, you can kill anyone who's the cause of your death, but you can't kill a woman, you can't kill a child, you can't kill an old man, you can't kill a cow. And it wasn't that the aggression was happening right there. It's just that this was a future thing that was going to happen. The unembodied voice from the sky announced this will happen. So Kamsa was wrong to take such an action. The unembodied voice from the sky was simply announcing his destiny. He was wrong to try to perform a sinful activity to counteract his destiny. It's not that Devaki was killing him. She's his sister. And why should his sister be held accountable for the behavior of any child she might have in the future? You understand? There has to be some principles, some regulations. It's not that we make up our codes of behavior as we go along. Well, Devaki is supposed to have a child in the future, is going to kill me, so what's wrong with protecting myself by killing my sister? This is the modern way of thinking. You adjust everything according to the circumstances. Business operates like that today, right? And they teach that to you, yes? They want you to have this attitude. This is the way to get ahead. I remember some years ago, there was a very popular business management book to inspire you in getting ahead. It was called How to Swim with the Sharks. Anyone read that one? Yes, it was very popular. How to Swim with the Sharks. In other words, be prepared to kill anyone, devour anyone, do what you have to do, but you have to get ahead.
Killer instinct.
Killer instinct.
Yes. They want to see. The company wants to see you have this for them, right? I have one disciple. He's doing his PhD in internet technology for at the University of Manchester. And from his undergraduate background, he had very high marks, very high recommendations. So when he was applying for his PhD, the people interviewing him told him, your grades look so qualified, but we're looking at you and you just look too peaceful. It doesn't seem to us that you have that urge to get ahead. I don't know if you're going to be suitable. I don't know if we can give you this grant. You just don't strike us as having that, you know, that that instinct for just annihilating all obstacles in your path. And so, you know, what can I say? You can contact my previous professors. You can ask them. So the lady did that, and then she got back to me saying, well, what can I, what? You know, all the professors are glorifying you so much, I guess we'll have to take you, but I don't know. You just lack that something. She picked up that, you know, there's something strange about this person. He's too placid. He's too tranquil. They cannot understand how such an attitude will accomplish anything. They want to see the killer instinct. And then, okay, they accepted him, but then a month or so ago, his PhD advisor told him, you know, I'm worried. I've lost quite a few PhD candidates over the years. They didn't make it past the first year. I have never seen a PhD candidate complete his studies without thinking that what he's studying is the most critical thing for the history of the world. I don't see that in you. I don't see that you are radiating this zealousness and fervor that your particular tiny facet of internet technology is going to revolutionize the whole world. I've never seen anyone get a PhD who doesn't have this attitude. So I'm worried about you. So then this devotee, he wrote me, asked what to do, what to do. They're doubting. They don't sense the Rajagun in me. They don't see any motive, passion. They're wondering, can I really do the job? And yeah, I said, well, what's the difficulty? I mean, he says, no difficulty. I'm doing the work. Everyone knows that, you know. Except I don't show enough passionate attachment. So then I was in South Africa at that time, and I consulted one devotee named Shyama Sundar. He's president of the temple in Pretoria. He's a young Indian man, and he is division head of Daimler Benz in South Africa. You know, that's the combination of Chrysler and Mercedes. He's division head of all South Africa, and he's a temple president of the temple at the same time. And he's just a humble servant of all the devotees. And he's just, his whole life is the temple. Yet, at the same time, he's a very successful business executive. Right now, they're considering putting him on the board, which means you've made the supreme destination for Daimler Benz of all over South Africa. So I asked him, well, what to do, you know? What do we tell this devotee? He said, you just have to tell him that, you know, he's got to play the game. First of all, you got to deliver. You have to produce what you are supposed to produce, and then you've got to just put on the right attitude. Yes, yes, what I'm doing is the most important thing. Yes, this is the greatest. That's all part of the working life. He's got to do that. I said, yes, that's what I've told him. I've already told him that he is not engaged in a brahminical activity. That's the illusion, that the PhD studies is a brahminical activity, free from politics, free from economic incentives. I said, forget it. This is business. Why is the University of Manchester giving you a grant? Is it because they're interested in pure intellectual research? No, it's because British Telecom wanted something figured out for their business, and rather than hire someone, they gave the money to the University of Manchester in the form of a PhD grant for you to do the work. So it's all business. So why are you acting like it's a pure intellectual affair? Everyone has to be very, you know. No, it's just strictly business. British Telecom gave the money to the university to give to you so you could do this research project. And you're actually just working for British Telecom, actually. But in the process of doing this research, you get the PhD title while doing British Telecom's work for them. So they don't have to pay a full employee to do it, and you get a PhD in the process. So it's, you know, everyone's scratching each other's back. So you have to understand that. This is the game. And you have to play the game. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, every endeavor in this world has some fault. Just like fire always has a little bit of smoke associated with it. Even if you're a brahmana, when you're doing yajnas, there's some fault. So what to speak of? You're engaged in, you know, your PhD activity. You can't have a sentimental understanding of it. All right, you're not a passionate person. You're a peaceful, placid devotee. But when you go to the academic offices, you've got to put on, you know, the show. Yes, this is so important, this particular tiny aspect of internet technology that I'm researching. It's going to change the whole world. I'm completely convinced of that. You got to do that. Otherwise, why study then? I told him, if you're going to study, then study. You've got to get into it. And I said, this is how you think. Why should you put on these attitudes? Because by your studying your PhD at University of Manchester, you can preach. You get facility, you get a room at the university for preaching to other students. So when you're talking to the university staff, you can show enthusiasm for preaching, and they'll take it as enthusiasm for your PhD project. So when you're talking to your advisor, just think, preach, preach, preach. This is giving me preaching facility. I can teach Krishna consciousness to so many people at the university. Think about that and get excited. And they'll simply see your face and think, oh, he's excited about the project. I said, furthermore, let's face it, you're not going to be a brahmachari. You're going to be a grihastha very soon. How are you going to support yourself? So you should think Krishna is so kindly arranged. You just do this PhD thing, and then you can get a teaching job somewhere, easily support your family, and go on preaching. So why don't you see it in that way? And I said, finally, you know as well as I do that British Telecom gave enough money to the university, not only to pay for your studies, but also to support you. So here you are, you're getting paid to do your PhD, and half the time you're preaching, so this is a great arrangement. So just be enthusiastic about Krishna's arrangement, but the university staff will take it if you're enthusiastic about the mundane thing. So he did that. You know, whenever he would see the university people, he'd be smiling. And they were very impressed. Oh, he's got that passion now. He's got that vigor. He's got that dedication. But in his heart, he's simply thinking, this is a great situation for serving Krishna. How can I use it more for Krishna's pleasure? So anyway, the point is that in material activities, people want to see your passion. But a devotee doesn't have material passion. A devotee has dedication to Krishna's pleasure. But often people don't understand that. And therefore there's this fear. If I become Krishna conscious, I might lose my competitive edge. I might bomb out in the workplace because I won't show that I have that killer instinct. Right? Of course, I know no one here would ever think that. Right? I heard everyone's mind say, yes, we do. But everything is possible with proper guidance. And bhakti yoga, for practicing bhakti yoga, it's essential that you have guidance. Just like our Bodhi monk, for those of you who know him before he went to India. He was working corporate executive job in Melbourne. And he was wondering, he asked me this question some years ago, what to do? People want to talk to me all day about nonsense things. Because, you know, it's Australia. You just can't simply talk business. Australians, they like mateship. They like, you know, going to a bar or sitting down and, yeah, and just talking this and that. Bonding, they call it. And, you know, I appear very strange. I don't drink beer. You know, I don't eat meat. But, you know, and I'm in charge of a big section. So if I don't have any relationships with the employees under me, it looks very strange what to do. They want to talk about things, you know? And if I just, you know, block them out, I cannot engage in nonsense talk. Then it will be very detrimental for my career. So I explained to him. I said, this is what you do. Find one subject that you can talk about comfortably, that won't agitate your mind. You can talk about it comfortably, and everyone will be impressed, and they'll leave you alone about everything else. So I said, there must be one subject. Just like sometimes I'm around mundane people, quite a bit, even as a sannyasi, and they want to talk about this and that, and, you know, I'm dressed as a devotee, but Westerners don't understand that, you know, you don't talk to a sadhu about mundane things. You know, they don't. Oh, that's a nice, interesting outfit you're wearing. What do you do? Where are you from? And, you know, and then you want to talk about so many things. You're sitting on a plane for 12 hours, flying from Mumbai to Sydney. You just can't, like, block the person out. And they get, like, a bad impression of Krishna consciousness. You know, these people are very cold, like this, that. So you have to do some talking, you know? And gradually you might try to stir the steer the conversation around to Krishna. So I told him, I said to Buddhimanta, you know, what I do, you know, when they want to hear something mundane, I start talking about traveling, airlines, because I know more about airlines than traveling. So I can tell them things that they never know about airlines. You know, Qantas does like this, their computer system for reservations works like that. You can get a cheaper ticket by doing this way and that way. And they're just, oh, really? Wow, amazing. I never knew you. How did Krishna knew all this? Because, you know, if you can show someone how to save money, they worship you. As you know, a demigod. You have to save me $20. So I said, this is what I do. I just start talking about traveling, airlines. I can do that very easily. It doesn't agitate my mind. You know, I can just rattle something off, and that way the people leave you alone. They figure, oh, you're an all right guy. There's something we can relate on, you know? So I said, what's it for you that you can talk about that is comfortable for you, doesn't agitate your mind, and the people will be satisfied? He said, well, you know, every year the company has its annual cricket match, and I'm always the captain. Everyone knows I'm the star. So I said, great, just talk about cricket all the time with the Australians. And then they'll leave you alone. So he started doing that. As soon as he walks into the office on Monday, did you hear about that test match Saturday? Oh, I can tell you exactly what went wrong, this, that, and the other. And then everyone gets enlivened. And so then they start talking amongst themselves. Well, he's a little different. He's a little aloof. But when it comes to cricket, he sure knows cricket. Yeah. And that way they have a handle on him, you know? He makes sense in some way without compromising his spiritual profile. Because he can easily talk about cricket, even in his sleep. It's just not agitating his mind. So he just, you know, whenever they want to bother him, he just starts talking about cricket. And they're, oh, you know so much. Really? Can you explain why this happened, why that happened?
Yes.
And that way, they have him categorized. He's different. He's got, you know, he's Indian. He's got, you know, he's a real Indian. We have many others here who, you know, they have adjusted, but he's still a real Indian, but no one knows cricket better than him. If you want to talk cricket, go talk to Grover Ajay Gore. He knows cricket inside and out. And they talk like that. They were talking like that amongst themselves, you know. Yeah, this one, that one. They're talking about this manager, that manager. Yeah, but that guy. I mean, really. I mean, he doesn't drink. Not too bad. He doesn't smoke. Anyway, he sure knows his cricket. And that way he makes sense in some way to them, which is necessary in the working world. You know, you just can't, like, just sit there and block everybody out. Simply focusing on Krishna. If you're going to be like that, why go to work? What was Arjuna thinking while he's fighting in battle group Kshetra? And he's thinking how to do his job, shoot arrows. So if you're going to work, work. But who enjoys the fruits of your work? That is the thing. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you are entitled to your duty, but you're not entitled to enjoy the fruits. So it was very easy for Buddhimanta to detach himself from the situation because he's working to support a Krishna conscious family. He's working to support the preaching of Krishna consciousness. So his whole work activity was an act of bhakti yoga. So similarly, I pointed out to this devotee who's studying in England, internet technology. I said, look, you know, British Telecom, by way of the university grant, is supporting you. You're preaching. And not only do you get financial support for preaching, but you get a place at the university. You can get so much facility for programs. So just look at it in that way and do the necessary. In this way, if we simply have guidance, we can easily balance our working life with our Krishna consciousness. It's not a problem. Krishna consciousness is practical. It's not something dreamy, fairy tale-ish. Oh, if I get too much into this, I'll lose my competitive edge. You just talked to Vishyama Sundar from Pretoria, division head for Daimler Benz of all South Africa. When he's at work, he's at work. He's bubbling over. Mercedes, we're selling so many cars, this and that. We're about to build a whole new plant. You know, the TV comes to interview him. Yes, new plant in Johannesburg. 5,000 jobs will be created. He really gets into it. Then, when it's time to go home, he just forgets it all and goes and dances in the kirtan and manages the temple. He's happy because he's using his job for Krishna's pleasure. Therefore, he's happy. Yes, he drives the flashiest Mercedes, because if you're division head of Mercedes, you got to drive the flashiest Mercedes. It's part of the job. I took a picture of him in front of his car, and I said, we're going to show this to all devotees. That you become a devotee, this is what you get. But you can see he's not attached to it. He's just, you know, that's just required for his job. How can you be the division head of Mercedes in the whole of South Africa and not drive the flashiest Mercedes? Everyone knows if you're the division head or even any employee, you get a company discount. So why aren't you driving, you know? And people in the company will wonder, hey, you are pushing Mercedes, you're not even driving a representative model, what's the use of you? So he does what's necessary. Yeah, he drives the flashy Mercedes, the latest one. But he knows, my working is for Krishna's pleasure, to support my Krishna conscious wife and her child, who are all chanting Hare Krishna, and to support the temple. I'm the president there. You know, they just bought the building that they were renting. He has ambitious plans. I'm going to pay off the mortgage in 5 years. Why wait 20 years to pay off this mortgage? I've got a plan to organize the community, the congregation of devotees. In 5 years, we'll pay for everything. He's ambitious like that for Krishna. So where's the loss of the competitive edge? But he knows why he's competing. Therefore, he's full of confidence. There was a challenge at his company, because there's always envious people, you know? They always try to bring you down. So someone wrote a complaint about him that he's got the worst division. I don't know why he gets so much glorification. I can tell you so many things are going wrong in his division. So the board called him in and said, actually, we know that this is some envious person. But still, what should we do about it? You know, it's our company policy that we try to honor all feedback, you know. So, Shamsun just called him. Oh, no problem. Test it. Test it. Call human resources. Have them survey everyone in my division. See if they think that this is true. So, no problem. Go see what my people think. Have human resources go and, you know, do the personnel tests and attitudes testing of the people in my division. See if they agree. I don't test it. They were saying, well, maybe we should just, you know, do nothing about this complaint. No, 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 no. Test it. See if it's true or not. Let's see what's best for the company. Yeah, this complainer feels this way and that way. I agree he's probably envious, but just test it out. We are scientific here in this company. Have human resources. You know, ask all the people in my division, how do they feel about me? Come on. So they did. The human resources department, you know, went in there and they had their surveys and their psychological questions, you know, to find out, you know, what's going on. And came back with a glowing report. Oh, this person, you know, he's such our best manager. Everyone says he's got integrity. He's got reliability. They can trust him. So that was the end of it. Now they're considering putting him on the board, which is like the supreme destination. It means your life is set once you're on the board. Yeah. So, this shows you it is possible to deal with the working world very nicely in Krishna consciousness. So this devotee in England who was studying internet technology for his PhD, he just needed some guidance, that's all. It was a momentary lack of understanding, but because he asked for guidance, it was easily solved. The situation was easily solved. But forget this craziness that if I become Krishna conscious, I'll lose my go-ahead drive, I'll lose my killer instinct, and I won't be employable. That is just nonsense. I know none of you ever thought that, though. So. All right, any questions?
Swamiji, the steps that Vasudeva took to counteract what Kamsa was doing at that time, obviously you know that Kamsa is stronger, but Vasudeva was Kshatriya. So this diplomatic stand we need to take, I'm sure if you work, so you need to counteract with your boss.
Yes.
So how we can relate this? I find it sometimes with blur minds, because this is sort of like bootlicking. If you are just pleasing that person, which you are not meant to.
Well, why do you take the job then? Job means bootlicking.
See, we got some job assigned if we are working for a company.
But not, just by taking employment, you are bootlicking. Right?
Yes.
When you, at your job interview, you promise to lick boots, right? I will please the company. I will please the managers, right?
When I say please the manager or please the company, it's not like there is job description you meant to attend with it. What I really mean is there is sometimes gray lines of gray, you know.
Right, lines of gray, right. Yeah. But I'm trying to get you to understand that as soon as you accept employment, you're agreeing to bootlick for the purpose of getting a salary. Just accept that. That's why in Vedic culture, Brahmanas are not allowed to accept a salary, so that they won't be under anyone's control. So you're not doing a Brahminical activity. You're taking a salary. You're promising service in exchange for a salary. That's bootlicking. And I know I'm taking all the mystique away from it. You have to please someone in order to get your money, right?
But this diplomatic stance, is it recommended?
You have to do what's necessary in order to protect your Krishna conscious lifestyle. If you're working for Krishna's pleasure, then you can do whatever is necessary without being immoral in order to protect the maintenance of your Krishna conscious lifestyle. All employment is the promise that you're going to please someone in exchange for money, right? Why look at it in a romantic way? It's all about pleasing someone else so they'll pay you. So, since that's the case, go do it! But if you're working for maintaining a Krishna conscious home and supporting the teaching of Bhagavad Dharma, then do what's necessary. Arjuna did what was necessary in fighting in the battle of Kurukshetra. What happened when Karna got his chariot wheel stuck in the mud and he got down off the chariot to fix the wheel, and then Krishna drove the chariot of Arjuna up, and Arjuna, knowing the laws of warfare, was not going to do anything because you don't attack a man when he's off his chariot. What did Krishna say? Right. There was no mercy for Abhinanda. Abhimanyu. 7-8 extraordinary powerful warriors, Maharadis, killed him, ganged up on him. So there'll be no mercy for Karna. Kill him. And Arjuna did it.
No, but then wasn't that revenge?
Huh?
You know, you're treating somebody exactly in the same manner that...
But Krishna ordered it.
Because Karna is powerful than Arjuna.
Krishna ordered it, that's the point. Krishna is Dharma.
Okay, I mean, what I'm asking is why Krishna ordered this one to Arjuna? Because
Karna was part of the pack that had ganged up on Abhimanyu wrongfully. So Krishna said, there was no mercy for Abhimanyu, there'll be no mercy for Karna. Krishna administers reactions. He's Dharma. So you can't blame Arjuna. Arjuna wasn't going to do anything, but Krishna said, no mercy.
That is tit for tat policy, right? That's what the people are doing now.
But everyone gets the reactions for their actions. What's wrong with Krishna? Dharma himself gives the results of activities. What's wrong with that? You don't like Krishna doing that?
He should be the symbol of good.
Huh?
He should be the symbol of good.
Yes. Therefore, he said, kill Karna.
See, with Karna, a lot of people don't know his past life.
Yeah.
Karna was a demon in the past life, and that's why they feel they don't see his past life, and that's why they feel very attached to this activity. But what was happened here was a reaction to the past life. He was a big demon, and that's why he went through this.
But I'm saying even regardless of his past life, in the present life, he had done very wrong. He had killed Arjuna's son wrongly. So Krishna said, there'll be no mercy for you.
Karnasana was also killed in the same way. Brajasena was Karnasana.
Anyway, let's just focus on this one thing. That Arjuna, while fighting Battle Kurukshetra, did all that was necessary under Krishna's guidance to win the war. He didn't say, oh, I cannot fight, I cannot do this or that. In the beginning he was saying like that, and Krishna told him, this is nonsense. Krishna told him, Mama Nushma Yujam Cha, fight and think of me. So, regardless of what Karna did in the previous life, the point is, Krishna is Dharma himself. The whole sanctity, meaning the whole sacredness of the Battle of Kurukshetra, is based on Krishna's saying, Arjuna, fight because it's proper. Otherwise, Arjuna wasn't going to fight. He didn't want to do it. But Krishna said, you must fight. It's your duty as a Kshatriya to stand up for the innocent, and it's also my desire. So you cannot understand Bhagavad Gita unless you understand that Krishna is Dharma himself. How can you criticize Dharma personified? That is my point. Now you have to wrestle with this point if you're going to really understand Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata. Otherwise the whole meaning is going to, you're going to miss. You can't judge Krishna when Krishna is the ultimate authority. Usually Krishna plays by the rules, his rules. But sometimes he breaks them. But he's the one who makes the rules. Sometimes he doesn't follow them. But he requires you to follow them. So you cannot judge Krishna.
No, it's not trying to judge Krishna, it's trying to know the rule. What is the rule?
The rule, ultimate rule is whatever Krishna wants.
But what he wants, we don't know in day-to-day life. How do we figure it out?
That's why we have the process of bhakti yoga, to find out what Krishna wants. Very good. Now you'll take it? Or you have a better method?
No, this is the process of bhakti yoga. When you're talking to you, just...
Yes, I'm telling you what Bhagavad Gita says. Now, maybe you have another way. What shall I do? I shall be a popular sadhu in India. Whatever you do, it's okay. Just have a good feeling of devotion in your heart. All activities are meant for the same goal. That goal is the ultimate end. You just think in your mind that this is for the ultimate, and you do everything, and then everything will be fine. So I start talking like that?
No.
Yeah.
You're looking for something more logical and...
more authoritative. And Krishna is the supreme authority. Therefore, yeah. He speaks Bhagavad Gita.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah.
Swamiji, by Bhakti Yoga, you mean we have to follow the inner voice for taking any actions in the life, right?
Which inner voice?
Inner voice. Bhakti
Which one?
Yoga.
Which one?
I want to take some decision. So, logically, this one is correct, but sometimes it follows, no, you have to follow this one, even though this seems correct. And I follow that voice and it seems
Which voice? Correct.
Inner voice.
He's
which
he's
one?
Talking
inner
voice. I know, but I'm asking, which voice?
Inner voice.
Which one? So many voices speaking in your mind at the same time, right? So how do you pick which one to listen to?
logical one, like sometimes it seems that this one is correct, but the inner voice says that no.
Which inner voice? So many voices are speaking in your mind. You have impressions from your parents, from society, they're all speaking in your mind.
No, apart from this, like the voice comes from me, like you have to follow this.
How do you know who you are?
It comes naturally, like.
How do you know that's really you? The mind is very wild, you know? In other words, until you become purified, you don't know what is your true voice. And it's very dangerous in an unpurified state to say, I'm just going to listen to the voice within.
So, should we follow that or not?
No. You should follow what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. And then Krishna promises you, once you reach a certain level of purity, He'll talk to you personally in your heart as the super soul. But Krishna says He only talks to those who are pure. So in the beginning, you have to purify yourself so that you'll be able to hear Krishna's voice in your heart as the super soul. Not that anyone should just listen to the voice within.
What's the test of purity then?
That you simply want to act for Krishna's pleasure. Just like Arjuna fought for Krishna's pleasure.
And if you feel that you are doing that, and at the same time, this kind of voice comes, so will you believe that voice?
Are you doing everything for Krishna's pleasure?
Yeah.
Not really.
Hopefully. It is possible. It's a goal that you should work for. Krishna says, Satatam Kirtayantamam, always chanting my glories. So if you're doing everything for Krishna's pleasure, you're always chanting Hare Krishna. You're always dedicating all the results of your activities for Krishna's pleasure. That doesn't mean just mentally, I'm doing this for Krishna, and then you take all the results for yourself. I know so many so-called sadhus in India say like that. Just in your mind, you dedicate it to, and then you take. I'm happy that you're wanting to be serious about the science of bhakti yoga. And then when you make further progress in that bhakti yoga, Krishna promises He'll talk to you and tell you personally what to do. In the meantime, Krishna asks that you take guidance from His representative, the guru, who instructs you on behalf of Krishna. The spiritual master is the external representation of super soul in the heart. Arjuna accepted Krishna as his guru, and Krishna told him what to do. Okay? Yes.
Maharaj, what is destiny?
We'll talk about that in our next session. Remember the criticism? What's holding India back is this belief in destiny, this fatalistic conception that your karma has predetermined everything.
Okay, one more thing. Can someone change his destiny?
We'll talk about that this afternoon. It is predestined for this afternoon. Alright, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.